Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Professional basketball and all that jazz. Hello again, I'm Norman Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCLW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. The city of Anaheim has approved a $75 million bond issue to get a third professional basketball team in Southern California. But steps to move the Kings from Sacramento have been delayed. A new proposal means the NBA might get more money if the Kings stay where they are. Are professional sports franchises really a good deal? Also tonight, a new program at UCLA for America's original form of music, jazz. We'll talk with a legend, guitarist and professor, Kenny Burrell. Later on, today's taxes and tomorrow's financial problems. First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Raising taxes has been anathema in Washington for 30 years, but the national debt has raised fears across the political spectrum. A new study shows even Tea Party Republicans would be willing to pay more. We'll hear about that later on. First, the chances of a third National Basketball Association franchise, along with the Lakers and Clippers, in Southern California. Today was the day the Maloof brothers, who own the Sacramento Kings, were set to apply for relocation to Anaheim. But L.A.'s own billionaire Ron Burkle got into the act, along with Sacramento mayor and former All-Star Kevin Johnson. Now they have 2 weeks to show the NBA Board of Governors a better deal if the Kings stay put. Eileen Voisin is a sports columnist with the Sacramento Bee. Eileen, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Tell us more about what's happening here. How did Kevin Johnson and Ron Burkle in Southern California get together?
Well, this happened after shortly after the All-Star game when David Stern made it pretty clear that he was frustrated with the region of Sacramento region's inability to come up with some financing mechanism for a new building. Sacramento's needed a new sports and entertainment arena for, you know, over a decade now, and that's never been a secret. I think everybody up here acknowledges that. You know, for a number of reasons, the physical state of the building, along with the fact that, you know, it's getting increasingly difficult, particularly for sporting events, if you want to compete with other cities to hold events, NCAA tournaments, you know, gymnastics, women and men, whatnot. So that's kind of been in the backdrop here. So the All-Star game, David Stern made it pretty clear that after a number of failed attempts to get together on an arena, we're talking really a lack of leadership on the county levels, on the city levels, previous mayor not really being engaged in it. So Stern, who's been very closely involved in at least two undertakings here, pretty much got frustrated in September and threw up his arms and said it's up to the Maloofs to decide what they want to do, but they need a decision. They need to do something within a year, some resolution. Well, the Maloofs were pretty committed, I thought, through December, but I think they were shocked when they found out that the team was not very good and it was not drawing. I mean, attendance was down again. And, you know, in a small market, these type of buildings, you know, attendance is huge. Fannies in the seats is really they're almost their main source of revenue here because they own the building and they generate all the money off parking and concessions. You know, that goes to them, unlike most of the arenas in the country that are not owned by the people that own the team per se. So there was a combination of things. So the Maloofs, I think, got really nervous in January. We heard that their finances, the Palms, increasingly perilous. And so then they pretty much decided, you know, they're going to seriously entertain offers. And Anaheim had been aggressively pursuing them for years. You know, as everybody in Los Angeles is aware, you know, Henry Samueli's wanted a team, and they almost had the Clippers. You know, so I think, so he came very aggressively, and the Maloofs this time decided to listen. So when, after the All-Star game, when Stern came out and reiterated the fact that the franchise here was in jeopardy, my understanding was that Ron Burkle and a number of local politicians, Democratic politicians, basically met, and Burkle said, I want to do something. I want a team in Sacramento. I'm a Californian. I want to keep a team there. What do I do? And so that, in the backdrop, that was working on behind the scenes here. And in the meantime, you had a number of, like, grassroots efforts. Greg Lukenbill, who actually brought the team here, got together with some people trying to come up with some financing mechanisms. And it finally generated some interest, people, you know, you put them on the spot, like you're on the verge of losing a team, and I think people really start getting it because, you know, they've been talking about, this talk about a franchise leaving has been ongoing for 10 years. And I think that, you know, finally now people are starting to understand that this is a serious threat to them not having an NBA franchise in Sacramento. We can get back to a number of reasons, if you want, about why they even got to this place to begin with. I mean, if they were filling the building and the product on the court was good, I do not believe that we'd be having this conversation, at least not to the extent that we are. I mean, I think everybody knows, again, that they need a new building here, whether the Kings stay or go. They need a new building here.
Eileen Voisin, we'll come back to you in a moment, sports columnist for the Sacramento Bee. First, let's talk with Lance Pugmire, who's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much.
What about Anaheim, and how does Anaheim feel about this delay of 2 weeks, all of a sudden granted by David Stern?
Well, they're a bit concerned about it, no doubt about it. I mean, they were expecting this application for relocation to be turned in today, as you said, and now it's been delayed by 2 weeks, and there is some concern that, hey, maybe they're giving the Burkle and Mayor Johnson more credibility than they deserve, because even David Stern had said at the in past discussions about the new arena in Sacramento, it's been met by a lot of eye rolling in that office. But the fact that Ron Burkle is such a prominent businessman and has the potential to do this, that's something that we need this relocation committee to do some fact finding on it and see how credible it is. Anaheim will be very quick to tell you that, look, you're going to have to go through rezoning, all the things that it takes to build a building on 230 acres of downtown property in Sacramento, versus we have an arena ready to go that was built with the idea of we're going to have an NBA team here in the first place nearly 20 years ago, and we're ready to go. It's going to be we've already approved, the city of Anaheim has already approved $75 million dollars in bond money, $25 million of which is earmarked for improvements to the Honda Center in Anaheim, and another $50 million, which is will go to the Maloofs for relocation fees that they need. So they feel like, look, we're in a far better place to handle this than Sacramento is.
Lance Pugmire at the Los Angeles Times. Andrew Zimbalist is a professor of economics at Smith College, studies the business of sports. His latest book is Circling the Bases, Essays on the Challenges and Prospects of the Sports Industry. Professor, good to have you on our show.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Warren.
How good a deal has it been for cities? We think back in Los Angeles, for example, to whatever happened to the Los Angeles Rams and the Los Angeles Raiders.
The evidence from the scholarly literature on the subject is that having a sports team or having a new arena or stadium in your metropolitan area doesn't help the local economy. The sports team by itself or an arena or stadium by itself doesn't promote development, doesn't promote employment. Now, there are particular cases where the thing is done right and the financing is done right, where you can have a small, modest, positive effect. And there are also cases where those things are done poorly and you can have a negative effect. But on balance, teams and arenas and stadiums by themselves don't have much of an economic impact one way or the other.
What's an example of a good one? What's an example of a bad one?
Well, I think there are lots of examples on both sides. Let me give you one example of a good one. I'm not sure that it's prototypical in any sense, but in 1982, Minneapolis built the dome where the Vikings and the Twins have played all of these years. Of course, the Twins last year went to Target Field, and they left the dome stadium. Minneapolis actually spent 100% of the funding for that. It cost $84 million. But they had a good rental agreement with both of the teams. They got good rental income. They got a share of the revenue. And the fact that they had two teams playing there all these years with shares of the arena take meant that they got actually got a pretty good return, somewhere in the neighborhood of 90% return on their investment of $84 million. So that's a good example. Other good examples these days tend to be cases where the owner of the team commits not only some money towards the building of the facility, but commits to develop land around the facility. In San Diego, for instance, the construction of Petco Field many years ago, John Moores committed to an investment of over $2 billion in developing residential, hotel, retail, and commercial buildings around Petco Park. And so I think that's a positive story. There are other stories like that. Most of the other stories, however, are negative, where you don't have a commitment of private resources to complement the public investment in the facility. You tend to get fiscal problems, deeper fiscal problems for the city than you had before. And the reason for all of this is that even though sports franchises are tremendously prominent in our culture, they're small employers economically. The typical front office of a sports team might have 70, might have 100, might have 130 employees full time. The other people are working on a very part-time basis during the days of the game. They're unskilled laborers. They get low wages. Most of the money that gets spent at a sports facility is spent there by local citizens instead of spending the money at a bowling alley or a movie theater or a restaurant. So it's just money transferred within the local community. And there are also a lot of leakages off of a sports team. If the Kings should move to Anaheim and become the Royals, the greatest likelihood is that the vast majority of the people on the roster, the players on the roster, won't live in Anaheim. I suspect it would be likely that the Maloofs wouldn't live in Anaheim. And so much of the money that was spent and paid out to the players and the owners wouldn't stay in the Anaheim economy. In contrast, if the people, instead of going to the Anaheim Royals basketball team games in the future, took their families to restaurants, took their families to bowling alleys, and so on, the proprietors of the restaurants and the bowling alleys are more likely to be local year-round and more likely to spend that money in the local economy.
Andrew Zimbalist, again, professor of economics at Smith College. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Sure.
Let me go back to Lance Pugmire with the Los Angeles Times. The Maloofs, it sounds like, from what we heard earlier, are people who need money. They're not going to contribute anything, are they, to the rebuilding of the stadium, or am I wrong?
Well, right now the way it's done is that the bond measure that Anaheim has approved is basically a transfer in which it's being firmly backed by three companies of Henry Samueli, who owns the Ducks and runs the Honda Center, and those companies are backing the money. The Maloofs would not. No, they are just looking for a better deal, and right now Anaheim is offering the better deal.
Is Samueli then going to contribute to develop land around the Honda Center, for example, or contribute to the economy in some other way?
You know, it's not going to be a development of land around the Honda Center. I think that there's talk of what this may result in is a new practice facility for the team, but that's been the only, outside the arena property venture that they've discussed.
There was a signature gathering effort in Anaheim telling people not to go for this at some point, or trying to tell city officials not to go for this because of the $75 million in bonds that the Anaheim City Council has approved unanimously. But it turned out, I gather, that the signature gathering effort was sponsored by the Committee to Save the Kings in Sacramento.
Exactly, yes.
So yeah, it got kind
of
nasty.
And the mayor of Anaheim has assured that, look, we are just the middleman here. This is a Henry Samueli mission that's going on here, and we are just the middleman. The taxpayers are not going to be on the hook for this bond measure.
Who is? How can he say that if the public has to raise $75 million?
Samueli has said that he is fully backing this money, and it's merely a loan that will be paid back. Now, the NBA does want to, this is part of this 2 weeks. The NBA wants to know everything about the money that is being spent, how it will be repaid.
Okay.
A good part of it could come from a richer television deal that the Royals, the Anaheim Royals, would get being in Southern California versus what they get in Sacramento.
All right, let's go back to Sacramento, where there's still the Sacramento Kings and Eileen Voisin. It's my understanding that the president pro tem of the state Senate, who hails from Sacramento, wants to have a state law about teams not being able to move unless they can pay off all of their debts. Is that designed to keep the Maloofs and the Kings in Sacramento?
Well, honestly, Senator Steinberg is, as you mentioned, a Sacramentan, and I have full faith in him, but I don't think that's really the reasoning behind it. I think it's kind of almost a comical undertaking for a number of reasons. I don't think there's any way that David Stern would ever let one of his franchises split from the city, owing the city $77 million, or owing on a loan $77 million. I would be very surprised on that, because the league would take another massive image hit on that, and they're taking image hits enough on the recent relocations, you know, Seattle, Oklahoma City, you know, Charlotte goes here, New Orleans goes there. I mean, it's almost like, you know, I've covered sports for 30 years, and I think it's almost a debilitating effect. Let's not talk economically, just in terms of your fan base. You're trying to, you know, retain it and grow it. You know, and the NBA is far behind baseball and the NFL, as we know. So I don't really put a whole lot of measure in that. Although that said, I will also say that Sacramento is just a very different kind of community, and I'm interested to hear Professor Zimbalist's comments because I've read much of his work, and I agree with most of what he's saying here in terms of the good and bad of these franchises, these buildings. But I look at it in term, I think what Daryl and a lot of people here are looking at is not so much of it fueling the economic engine, although both places where they would look to put the arena are in need of major development, both downtown and the rail yards, and also the alternative would be Natomas, which is where it is now, that could be developed and needs development. I mean, that's an issue when the flood, you know, the flood laws are lifted in 2 years. But I look at these arena, these sports and sports facilities, almost as maybe more transformative of basically the appealability of a city. I mean, I remember going to Charlotte before they had an arena downtown. I remember downtown Phoenix, what that was like. I remember Kansas City. I mean, that is now just an incredible downtown, thriving, just a wonderful sports and entertainment area. And they look at Sacramento, an arena downtown, doing something like that. And I'll also say that
the only, only entertainment in Sacramento is the state legislature.
Well, you know, the only thing, the only sports, again, this is a one-team town. What the NBA likes and doesn't like, I mean, they like having the small market, but they like their small markets to be very exclusive. Portland, Salt Lake City, San Antonio, Sacramento, they're one-team towns. So it's almost like a monopoly. You have no competition.
Okay.
And people here, they wouldn't be, I don't think that they would be taking their money that they spent on Kings to go into restaurants and bowling. What they would be doing is getting in the car and driving 2 hours over to the Bay Area and going to 49ers games and Oakland A's games and Shark games and Cal Stanford games. That's where the allegiance is going to shift. I don't really see that money being shuffled and benefiting this community per se. I mean, I think you've got a very hardcore base of hardcore pro sports fans, partly because a lot of us moved from other cities. I'm from New York. I lived in Los Angeles, Atlanta. You know, I just see that there's a really a strong percentage, and there's a high disposable income right here. I mean, people, a very small corporate base, which has been problematic from day one, but it's got a very, you know, it's white-collar workers. Of course, we're all taking a beating now, but there's a pretty nice disposable income level here.
Okay.
And so I think that money goes elsewhere.
All right. Well, it's all about the money as far as the NBA Board of Governors is concerned, and no doubt we'll see if Ron Burkle and Kevin Johnson with their $9 million can compete with Anaheim and their $75 million in bond issues in a couple of weeks. That's what it's going to take. Eileen Voisin with the Sacramento Bee, Lance Pugmire with the Los Angeles Times, and our earlier guest, Andrew Zimbalist from Smith College. Thank you all very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Back in a moment with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
That is Kenny's theme in honor of our next guest. Kenny Morrell has been called a great guitarist by other great guitarists, including George Benson and Jimi Hendrix. He's played with musicians and singers, including Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, and Ray Charles, made more than 100 solo recordings. That may be a record. He's also Professor Kenny Burrell, who started UCLA's jazz concentration in 1996. He still runs it. And now with the Herb Alpert School and Herbie Hancock, he is working with the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz to establish a new graduate program at UCLA. Kenny Burrell, we didn't just have you on to listen to your music. It's really good to talk with you, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Warren. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. Tell us more about what is going to be not just a program for educating people in jazz, but also something that is going to be available to the community.
Well, I think it's a kind of a marriage of coming together of very rich resources here, both in terms of the funds and also the personnel and the musicians involved. I think it's a great coming together, and it's Southern California will truly benefit from this.
Describe the program. Who's going to be in it, and in what way will Southern Californians know about it?
Well, first of all, we have a great jazz studies program at UCLA, as you probably know, and we have a stellar faculty there. But now with the advent of Herb Alpert School of Music, which has unified all of our different departments, the Department of Ethnomusicology, the Department of Music, and the Department of Musicology, we have now a very, even on a more solid foundation at UCLA in terms of our education. And now the third new attraction and the third new element that's going to make this thing really miraculous is the Thelonious Monk Institute for Jazz, which has now found its new home at UCLA. And it's going to, and our first step in this marriage has been to create a graduate program in jazz, which will treat the students that are coming for the Thelonious Monk Institute. And these students come from around the world. They compete to become graduate students in this graduate program. So we've created a program especially for that, and that will be an interaction between our students that we have, most of them are undergraduate, with the new graduate students in the Thelonious Monk Institute. And I, like I say, that's an international kind of feeling there. And then the Herb Alpert School is overseeing all of it. It's really nice.
You talk to some kids these days, and they don't know about jazz. They're not interested in jazz. They think that's old news. How are you going to get them interested?
Well, I think it's all connected. I really think that once they become aware of this, the sound of the music, and understand, and that's one of the valuable things about UCLA and about our teaching, understand that it's all connected, that the history of the music that they're hearing now is related to music that went before, and jazz is a vital part of everything that they're listening to today. They just don't know it, and they have to be educated to that effect. And not only that, it also provides them with some new ideas about fusing various kinds of music together, jazz and hip-hop, jazz and all kinds of fusions of jazz and rock, jazz and classical. All of that is happening because of the history of this music. So we just have to let them know, and I see that all the time now with the students coming to UCLA. As they understand more about the history, they realize how exciting it can be and how rich it can be with that fusion.
And I understand that these students at UCLA are going to be teaching music at Los Angeles Public Schools?
Oh, yeah. We have a growing outreach program, and the students really get excited about taking it to the community. And we also have an in-reach program, which we bring the students from the community to UCLA for special workshops. So it's really going to be very nice.
And the graduate students are fully funded?
Yes. Oh, yeah. This is a scholarship program for them. And they have to compete. It's a real stiff competition to get in that. And it's not, you know, it's not a lot of students, but the ones who come in for the Thelonious Monk Institute, they're really special and very highly talented students. So, yeah, it's funded.
So they're already accomplished musicians, I gather, before they get there, and then they're going to be heard around the community and elsewhere.
That's right. Yeah, the outreach program is going to involve all of the students, and also with this Herb Alpert new school and the new funding, we're going to be able to present more great programs at UCLA for the community to come to, and many of them will be free.
Six to eight young musicians, I take it, are going to start. Is the program going to get larger than that?
Probably so, but we're starting with that amount of musicians.
How's it been working with Herbie Hancock and Herb Alpert?
Well, both of those guys are my friends for many years. Herbie Hancock and I made records and played together starting in the 60s, and we're still friends and still playing and doing things. And as you know, Herbie is soaring with his wonderful music. And Herb Alpert and I have been friends as well. Herb Alpert is one of the original sponsors of our jazz program when we were looking for people to help us to get this thing off the ground. He was one of the first people to come in and give us some money to help us survive. And now, he's given us this great multi-million-dollar grant for jazz and for not only just jazz, but for music, period, which allows us to combine many sources at our school and the three departments and other things.
And you're having fun with them, and you're still playing.
Well, I'm still playing because I love it. I have a great passion for it. And I have a new record coming out this late this summer, and And I love it. What can I tell you?
All right. Kenny Burrell, a lot of people love you as well. Professor Kenny Burrell, I should say, at UCLA. Thanks a lot for being with us. We're going to go out with some Kenny Burrell music, playing with John Coltrane. Good to have you.
Thank you, Warren, and thank you very much for all of your work as well. Keep up the good work, please.
Thank you.
All right.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, today's taxes and tomorrow's financial problems on Which Way LA. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. Since the days of Ronald Reagan, it's been an article of Republican faith that cutting taxes liberates money for the business investments that create jobs and increase prosperity. This day, when income taxes are due, is a good time to ask if that's true. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winner who wrote for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. He's now a columnist at Tax.com, and he teaches at Syracuse University. David K. Johnston, welcome back to our program.
Well, thanks for having me on, Warren.
Should say, as we begin, that Ronald Reagan did, in fact, increase taxes.
Oh, 11 times, but he persuaded the White House press corps and others to call them revenue enhancers. And then, of course, the 86 Tax Act raised taxes on corporations, though those provisions have been largely undone by lobbyists over the last 25 years.
Nonetheless, as you say in your recent article, that things that the rich don't want you to know about taxes, Congress has not increased taxes for a long period of time, not until the Obama health care reform.
Yes. With one exception during the Bush years, a retroactive tax increase on teenagers who have jobs and or investments. We have not had any tax increases since of any significant note since 1993.
And that's based on the theories of Milton Friedman, the late Nobel Prize winner.
Yes, Friedman argued very strongly that, first of all, taxes take away your individual liberty, and he argued that privatizing things, getting government out of them, and lower tax rates would lead to this widespread prosperity and everyone would be better off. And George Bush ran for office promoting the same thing, saying, if you'll recall, that we had surpluses as far as the eye could see. There was no need to pay down our existing government debt, and you were going to have more money in your pocket if you elected him instead of the other guy.
What about the truth or falsity of Friedman's theory? Have we, in 30 years, been able to demonstrate whether it's right or wrong?
I think we have. I think the evidence is quite clear. We've had some benefits from this, but the bottom 90% of taxpayers, when you adjust for inflation, now get $1.01 for every dollar that they had back in 1980. So after 28 years, 1% increase in income, a little over $300 a year for the average income of the bottom 90%. At the top, the story is quite different. The top 1%, that starts a little below $400,000, their income, they have almost $4 for every dollar they had back then. And the income growth has been highly, highly concentrated in the top tenth of 1%, to the point where that 1 in 1,000 Americans now have almost as much income as the bottom 90% of Americans.
How has that worked out? Why is that the case?
Well, I contend that it's because lowering tax rates has encouraged withdrawals of capital from business. Imagine, Warren, you're a very successful businessman. You come towards the end of the year, you realize you're going to have several million dollars you didn't expect to have. If the tax rate on your business is 50%, which is what it was in the 70s and until Reagan changed the rules, you're probably going to say to yourself, you know, 50%, instead of giving half that money to the government, I think I'm going to expand my business. I'm going to buy some more equipment. I'm going to maybe pay better pay so that I get higher quality workers. But if the tax rate is much lower, you may well say, you know, be really nice to have a third house or a ninth house or a $80 million painting to hang on the wall. And that's what we've seen. The enormous bidding up of luxury second, third, ninth home real estate and objects to art and other unproductive consumption, and the movement of a lot of capital out of America overseas.
So your theory is then that we ought to increase taxes, and that would then coerce companies to reinvest?
Well, I think what we really need to do, Warren, is fundamentally reexamine our tax code. The tax code that we had up through the 86 Act, which was pretty good law, the bipartisan Ronald Reagan tax law, was designed for a national industrial wage economy. We have now gotten ourselves into a global asset-based digital economy. Most of the assets now they're not big factories where you can't move them. They're software programs and molecular structures, the ownership of which you can easily move around, as well as physically move the mathematics. And we need to update our tax system to reflect that, but keeping the ancient fundamental principle that every worldly philosopher has embraced, that taxes should be progressive. The greater the gain a society makes it possible for you to attain, the greater the share of your gain you should pay back so that society will endure.
David K. Johnston, again, now at Syracuse University College of Law and Whitman School of Management. There is some indication, believe it or not, despite the atmosphere in Washington, that Americans might be willing to pay more taxes. Stephen Kull is a political psychologist. He's director of the Center on Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland. pardon me, Stephen Kull, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, first of all, you're basing your conclusion that Americans might be willing to pay more taxes on a kind of a different kind of polling. Tell us about it.
That's right. Standard polling just asks people, would you favor or oppose having an increase in taxes or to cut spending and so on? And you often find that people say that they don't want to increase taxes or cut spending, but they still want to balance the budget, and it seems like it just doesn't add up. What we wanted to do was find out what would people do if they actually face the situation the policymakers face of needing to actually make a budget. So we presented to a representative sample of Americans who were online, but a probabilistic sample, the budget broken into 31 line items with some description of what went to each one, and then they were able to increase or decrease the amount as they saw fit, getting constant input about the effect on the deficit. Then we went on to taxes as well, and we went through the different income tax rates, and they could adjust income tax rates and have that. They would constantly get, again, input about the effect on the deficit. And we went into corporate taxes and alcohol taxes and VAT taxes or sales taxes and so on. So they had a big array of options, just like policymakers do.
What were the conclusions?
Well, it was really quite striking because on average, they did cut spending substantially, on average $146 billion. Perhaps most striking, they increased taxes on average $292 billion. That was all based on the year 2015. So on average, overall, they cut the deficit more than $400 billion.
Okay. Now, let's break it down from a partisan standpoint. When you say people wanted to cut spending, how did that break down, Democrats, Republicans, Independents?
Democrats cut it $157 billion, Republicans $100 billion, $101. And those sympathetic to the Tea Party, 100. So interestingly, Democrats cut more. But the ones who cut the most were independents at $196 billion.
Wow. Are there great differences in what they would cut that would explain those differences in the numbers?
One of the differences is that Democrats and independents were more willing to cut defense. They cut it significantly more deeply. But again, even, as I said, even the Republicans and those sympathetic to the Tea Party cut it more than $50 billion.
Okay. Now, what about increasing taxes?
Yes, they turning to income taxes, that was the source of the biggest change. They began to increase taxes In the 75 to 100,000 income range, and on average they increase that about 5%. Between 100 and 200,000, they increase that on average 7%, and then it went higher.
So they were progressive about it.
They got, basically that's what they did, is they made the whole system more progressive. And what's interesting is that's what that they did this irrespective of where their income was. So people in the higher income brackets basically did the same thing as people in the lower and middle income brackets. Wow. Basically, there's a consensus that the income taxes need to be made more progressive.
What seems to be the most important thing here? Is it the deficit or is it some idea of fairness?
Well, they understand the problem of a deficit. I mean, they can see that if you don't have enough income to cover your expenses, that you've got a problem. They have that experience in their own household budget. And so when you say, okay, here's the problem, right, you know, you make your own budget, show how you would deal with it, they sit down and they can solve it, and they understand that. It's just what in the political environment where there's just a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and advocacy for this or that, they can be pulled one way or the other. And then sometimes they hear that it's not really necessary to raise taxes, that we can solve it all by spending, and or that by cutting taxes you actually increase revenues, and they can get confused rather easily. But when you basically give them the whole picture, they can deal with it, they can cope with it, and they come up with a reasonable response.
Stephen Kull, Center on Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland. Carl Cannon is Washington editor for Real Clear Politics. Carl, good to have you back at our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Are these results surprising to you?
No. Not only are they not surprising to me, they're gratifying to me, and I'm going to call the professor when we're done, and I'm going to do a column about him, about his research. Warren, independents are the most willing to raise taxes, of course, because they're the group least caught up in the dueling catechisms of these two parties, you know, that have become, in an era of $1.5 trillion annual deficits, they don't seem so funny anymore. I mean, and so this is a group that wants to deal with the problem. But I would point out to you, though, that those numbers, even, you know, those numbers wouldn't, if you took all the cuts that they want in spending and all the tax increases, it wouldn't begin to deal with the deficits that we have now. So the public attitudes are ahead of the politicians, but the public attitudes still aren't commensurate with the dire situation that we're in.
What would it take if you cut spending by $146 billion, increase taxes by $292 billion, that would
do that gets you one third or one fifth of the way there. I mean, look, we know that the three of us could get together in a room and come up with a plan. The parties would attack it, but it's no mystery. You know, the president on Wednesday said he wanted a bipartisan working group in Congress to begin to look at this. Well, there are two things about that were a little dismaying. The first of all is there already is a bipartisan group in the Senate doing just that.
The Gang of Six.
So-called Gang of Six. And the other thing is that the Bowles-Simpson Commission, which, again, it was a nice start, you know, but it wouldn't have got you there, but it was a very nice start with pain on all sides, a sacrifice, the kind of sacrifice the president was talking about, shared across the board, except for tax increases. They shied away from that. But that was a pretty good working document. Those guys were invited there, and he kind of tipped his cap to them, but he didn't discuss their work. So it seems if you're an independent, which is what I am, it's nice to see that the independents are the most responsible group, but we haven't yet seen a plan, certainly not the Ryan plan and nothing what the president said, that really begins to tackle this problem.
Now, the Gang of Six is interesting because it includes some very liberal senators and some very conservative ones, and each of them, in each case, they're getting trouble from their own parties for going along with these proposals.
Well, yes, not so far yet the parties, but the party, the base, you know.
The base, okay.
Saxby Chambliss, the Georgia, he's one of the people I assume you met was very conservative.
Sure.
He certainly is. Eric Erickson of Red State, a blogger, says, you know, is Saxby Chambliss becoming a Democrat? Now, this is a guy who's, remember, he hasn't done anything yet. He's been willing to discuss the deficit, and he starts getting attacked. I think that shows the nature of the political problem that these gentlemen face.
Well, that's also happening to the liberal senator from Illinois.
Well, Dick Durbin, yeah. And Durbin, who is one of the most liberal people when he was in the House and now in the Senate, is very liberal. Yeah, Paul Krugman, you know, sort of casually slanders him the other day in his column. Oh, you know, this conservative Democrat, which in certain circles is a nasty thing to say about somebody. And so, yeah, he gets labeled already, again, merely for being in these conversations.
Carl Cannon, again, is Washington editor for Real Clear Politics. Steve Moore is a member of the editorial board and senior economics writer for The Wall Street Journal. Steve, good to have you on our program again.
Hi, Warren. Great to be with you.
You didn't hear the very first part of our program, but we spoke with David K. Johnston, who said that the anathema against raising taxes, the argument that what we need is lower taxes so that people will invest money in companies that create jobs, isn't working, and that, in fact, it works the other way. What you need to do, because they don't do it. They spend on their use profits for personal gain and for financial speculation. And what we really need to do is have more taxes in order to coerce them to reinvest, particularly in companies in the United States. If we have this consensus, as it appears from the Center on Policy Attitudes survey, that people would be willing to cut spending and increase taxes, where do you come down on the Milton Friedman theory?
Well, I don't think there's going to be any tax increase as long as there's a Republican House of Representatives. I mean, remember, Warren, the vast, vast majority of House Republicans have taken a blood oath that they won't raise taxes. In fact, as you know, I used to run a group called the Club for Growth, and that was the entry in that group, you had to swear off raising taxes. So what it's interesting. I have been listening to the last 15 minutes of the show. What I haven't heard any talk about is cutting spending. And let's get the spending problem under control, because I think most Americans understand most of the dollars they send to Washington are wasted. We got to do something about the entitlements. I disagree with Carl a little bit. I mean, we just had the most ambitious deficit reduction plan in the history of America released a week ago by Paul Ryan. And he's been pilloried by the left, saying, oh, we can't cut Medicaid, we can't cut Medicare. I worry that we're going to get stalemated, and the way out of the stalemate, I think, is to take taxes off the table and then start cutting. And as a conservative, I think, one, we have to put defense spending on the table. We have to cut just about everything to get this budget under control.
Back to Carl Cannon with the Real Clear Politics. What about Stephen Moore's contention that as long as we have the Republican Congress, we're not going to see any increase in taxes? Not worth talking about.
Well, look, Steve's old buddy, and he knows he's a smart guy. But the Republicans do not want to raise taxes. But when Grover Norquist, fellow traveler, Steve, would you say, he sent Tom Coburn and some of these Republicans of the Gang of Six a letter reminding them of their promise not to raise taxes, and they fired back a letter and said, you know, they had a higher oath, and it was the oath that they took to uphold the Constitution of the United States when they became senators. And I think if you have an emergency situation, you're going to have across the board very, I won't say severe, deep, I don't want to use a pejorative term, but a lot of spending cutting, which is what's probably required, to take a tax cut simply off the table is not giving the Democrats any cover, and it's probably not the way things get done in Washington. So I don't think that they can really stick with that forever. I think they're going to have to think about raising taxes, at least income taxes on the upper income people. And Warren, you know, this talk about the Bush tax cuts, how terribly regressive they are, that's unfair. I mean, the Bush tax cuts, the reason that the Democrats didn't let them lapse when they could have is those taxes were very progressive. At the same time, they were regressive. They lowered the top rate to the pre-Clinton number, but they also created a new tax bracket, 10%. They took millions of people off the rolls altogether. You have working poor who depend on that tax cut. So you can't just let it lapse, and the president knows this. But you could go back to a 39% rate for people, for millionaires. You could do that. And you know, Steve knows this. He doesn't want it, but you could try it and see if it works. You know, the rationale for George W. Bush cutting taxes was that we were in surplus. Well, we're not in surplus anymore.
Steve Moore, back to you. Do you think that the Republican members of the Congress see their oaths to protect the Constitution in the same way that the conservative senators do?
Well, you know, it's interesting because listening to Carl talk, I agree with some of the things that Carl was saying. Look, I think the big problem, Carl, I would never accept higher tax rates. I think we ought to, if we want to be a competitive country, we got to lower our tax rates, not raise them. I think you'll actually hurt the economy so much by raising tax rates, it'll be worse for revenues in the deficit. But here's the thing, Warren. I think where you can get a deal is talking about going back to the idea of reforming the tax system, broadening the tax base. Yes, Carl, I agree with you. I think the ethanol subsidy should be eliminated, and that's a tax subsidy. When you've got a situation like General Electric is paying no income tax or Whirlpool, that's a big problem. So what I favor, if we're going to raise revenues, let's reduce the tax rates, but broaden the base, get rid of the pollution, the credits, the carve-outs, the special interest loopholes. There, I think you have the basis for a deal. But if you're talking about raising tax rates, no, that is something I don't think you're going to get a single Republican to go along with.
Let me go back to our first guest, first part of our program, David K. Johnson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's been at both the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, and now teaching at Syracuse University, and also blogging. What do you say to what we just heard from Steve Moore with regard to no tax increase?
Well, Steve is very consistent in his view of the world. He wants lower tax rates, and here's a question I would raise. How low do we need them to go? If other countries lower them, are we going to keep saying we're going to cut and cut and cut? The foundation of all private wealth is built on commonwealth. It is taxes that provide the court system, the education system, the infrastructure, all the other things that make it possible for us to live in a well-to-do society. We are replacing solid foundations with sand. And if you build a skyscraper on sand, you know what will eventually happen to it. And I'm not sure we'll be as lucky as the Tower of Pisa and still be standing at an angle after a long time.
Steve Moore says that much of the money in Washington is wasted.
Steve just said, most people understand most of the money they send to Washington is wasted. That's simply not true. That's rhetoric that Steve uses. The fact is that we buy very valuable things with our money. Now, I certainly agree with Steve. We should get rid of all of these favorite things that are done for this party and that party. We don't need a mortgage interest deduction, which artificially inflates the price of housing. The Canadians don't have it, and they have the same home ownership rate we do. We don't need to have ethanol subsidies. We don't need a military as large as it is. We don't need these rifle-shot law provisions that allow companies like GE to pay little to no taxes year after year after year on their profits. We need a system that is broad-based, that has its principal goal as raising the amount of money needed to have a stable, healthy society. And on that, I think we'd have absolute agreement. And part of that's going to involve tax increases, and part of it's going to involve cuts in various kinds of government spending. But I think it would be grossly outrageous to say that it's the poor, the sick, and the disabled, as Congressman Ryan is proposing, who should first bear the brunt of this.
Steve Moore, what about that proposition?
Well, let me just correct myself because, you know, you're right. The latest Gallup poll, which I just saw last month, indicates that the mean amount of money that Americans think is wasted in Washington is about 35 cents. So it's not most of the money, but about a third of the money Americans think is wasted. So if we can get rid of the waste in Washington, and by the way, that's with respect to Medicare, Medicaid, I like the idea of giving it to states and letting them deal with the problem through innovation. And that's, by the way, that's the way we fixed welfare. We handed it back to the states. It was one of the great social policy successes. But look, to say that somehow that our private sector economy is built on government, I think is exactly wrongheaded. I think we spend way too much money in this country giving money to people who aren't productive, whether it's 2 years of unemployment benefits, record amounts of food stamps. You can't grow an economy by taxing the productive private sector and giving it to people that don't work. This is a problem we're going to have as we go ahead as a nation competing against countries like China and India. We have to be more productive. We have to reward productivity investment. And I don't think raising tax rates is going to do that. And remember, the last point, Warren, we all want to balance the budget, everybody that's on the show and all the people are listening. The best way to do that is to grow the economy. And the lesson of the last 25 years is keeping tax rates low, especially in an environment when the rest of the world is cutting tax rates, is really important in terms of growing investment and jobs in this country.
David K. Johnson, are we giving money to people who don't work?
Well, sure we are, because the failure of the very policies that Steve champions. In the last 10 years, the population has grown five times faster than jobs. The median wage in this country, half make more, half make less, has been stuck at $26,000. And I think that after 30 years of data showing that the bottom 90% of Americans' income is up one percentage point after 28 years, and we have these huge growth at the top, especially in the top 10th of 1%, that as a policy to take from the many and further enrich the few, it's been a great success. As a policy to build a solid, healthy country that will protect the liberties of the people and ennoble the human spirit, I think this policy has been a complete failure. We need to junk it and recognize that it's ahistorical, it's not built on the conservative principle of progressive taxation, and start with a new slate about how to finance that level of government that we need to have, not the level of government we do have.
Carl Cannon with Real Clear Politics, is this the argument we're hearing in Washington?
Well, this is a much, and you're the reason, Warren, but this is a much higher level than the argument we hear in Washington, so thanks for having us. But I would just say one thing. The fairness argument is, you're hearing that more and more, and the Democrats are using it. And I think it appeals to their base. It appeals to everybody's better angels. But we wouldn't be having that discussion if the budget was balanced. I mean, nobody thinks that there's anything intrinsically unfair about a 33% raise versus a 39% rate. It's that the money has to come from somewhere. And as David K. Johnston points out, I mean, the only people who can pay it right now, unless Steve Moore gets his wish, we have a whole new tax system, but the only people who can pay it are the upper-income people. They're already paying disproportionate. Don't make any mistake, GE notwithstanding. But they can afford to pay more, and the working poor and the middle class can't really.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that, we can find out in 2 weeks what the possibilities for compromise are when the Congress returns after its Easter recess. Thank you all very much. Carl Cannon, again, Washington editor for Real Clear Politics. Steve Moore, now on the editorial board and senior economics writer for The Wall Street Journal. David K. Johnston, currently at Syracuse University, former journalist. And Stephen Cull, thanks very much to you, a director on the Center on Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland for a new and different kind of poll. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way L.A. was produced tonight by Sonia Geis, Katie Cooper, and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us, share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla, or join the conversation on Which Way L.A.'s Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way L.A. on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way L.A. is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.